Today is Wednesday, September 21st. It's 2:43 in the afternoon and hi, this is John Williams and you're listening to The Mincing Rascals, portions of which are broadcast most Saturday nights. You can hear me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I am Neil Steinberg, columnist of the Chicago Sun-Times and author of Every Goddamn Day, a fun quotidian history of Chicago now available from the University of Chicago Press.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the increasingly alarmed publisher of the Picayune Sentinel weekly newsletter. My work appears occasionally in the Daily Herald now as well.
By the way, in the video pre-roll we did and are doing these days before we record this podcast, Neil spoke at some length about his book, and I recommend you check that out. You can find it. Maybe the best way to search for it would be on Eric Zorn's Picayune Sentinel. He'll post it there, but it's fun to talk about what I think is a really fun and informative book that people will really enjoy. Props to you on that, Neil. It's really neat what you've done.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it. I'm very excited about it. It kept me sane through COVID.
Eric, why are you, what's the adjective that describes you today?
I'm increasingly alarmed, and I'm referring to the recent Trump rallies and the former president's slouching toward this QAnon conspiracy theory. There's images from his rally in Ohio over the weekend where they're playing music in the background when he is talking, and the music is identified by the people in the audience as music that it's associated with the
it's their theme,
the QAnon theory, and they're all holding up their hands or their arms with a one finger salute, and it has so many resonances with Nazi Germany, and I know that this is considered to be bad form and alarmist and deranged to worry about this, but I don't see how anyone can deny it. I think you're in Trump delusion. You're suffering from Trump delusion syndrome if you're not concerned about the turn that this party is taking, yet another turn toward this really dark place.
This part of the party.
I'm going to be contrary and disagree with you, Eric, because I think, you know, once you start ignoring reality, the specifics of that reality, of the reality being ignored, hardly matter. And so I think people can and do ignore all that. And tell you the truth, I wish he would show up in a SS uniform and start Sieg Heiling each other, because to me, it's already clear he's a fascist and a traitor, and the more clear he makes it, the better. And so, you know, I'm not glad to see that, but I'm not surprised, and I expect it to get a lot worse. If someone hasn't figured it out by now, it seems naive to hope that now they're going to get it. I really think he could grow a little mustache and be clicking his heels together, and
suppose that the more he, and he wore the QAnon pin too, the more he associates with that, more he embraces that. I mean, he gets a lot of love there and a feeling of power there, but that's not, I'm going to finish this thought, mainstream Republicanism. That is so far to the
right. It is now.
Let me finish that thought, because I really think that. I don't think that path leads to victory in a primary or certainly in a general election. You get a lot of love for that, but that is not where conservative Americans are. They're not there.
One hopes, but given Joe Biden as a flawed candidate, if that's the, you know, I just think given what happened in 2016, you can't make any assumptions like that anymore. I think the danger is just growing. In other words, I don't want to dismiss Trump. So if Trump says the Holocaust didn't happen and Muslims should be in concentration camps, I don't think that means he can't get elected. I get frustrated sometimes seeing the media, because it seems like we're still playing off that dance card. And I don't think we can marginalize him. I think the threat is very real.
Yeah, but you're talking about him and I'm talking about them. I'm talking about people I know who identify as Republicans and not MAGA Republicans. Remember, Joe Biden spoke about MAGA Republicans.
But I think it's a false distinction. Okay,
I don't.
If I join the Nazi party because I like the uniforms and I don't like, I'm still a Nazi. Okay, so you might, you know, the only thing that matters is what happens when you go in that booth. And there are lots of Trump wannabes, you know, Ron DeSantis and on and on. And I think that they're going to get a lot of support, and we're going to find this brush fires of Trumpism cropping up everywhere.
Yeah, well, it seems like you're increasingly alarmed too, Neil. But
yeah, no, I'm not optimistic. I'm just, in other words, I'm not of a mind of now he's crossing some, you know, by embracing QAnon. But that's all he does. That's all he's been doing is trying to push this line further. And
well,
further
I don't know where the line is, Eric. I'll let you talk, and I'll stop cutting you off, Neil. I apologize, but it just seems to me like it's this slow march to a point where wherever the line is, it's a different places for different people. Eventually he gets to, he may be there now where people go, I can't do that. I don't like the uniform and I don't like the man and I'm not going to, maybe I won't vote, but I'm not going to vote for him. I can't vote for that. I have more faith in people, not MAGA Republicans, not people that have consumed the Kool-Aid, but I think there's enough people who previously voted for Trump who see this now and they say, I can't go there. I don't see this as growing his base.
Well, I wonder if that's true. We saw those images from that rally. I thought those images were very chilling. You know, the raised arms as he's speaking.
It was a smaller crowd than he normally speaks to. Go ahead, Eric. Keep going.
Right. But I'm saying that I think he's taken yet another dark turn. And I hope you're right, John. We're going to have a major test of your theory in the fall when we see what happens to people like Dr. Oz and Herschel Walker, these Senate candidates, J.D. Vance up in Wisconsin, Walker. Out west, there's some other candidates, too, who are really full MAGA. They're election deniers. And I don't know if they're QAnon or where they are related to QAnon. But you got to remember that this QAnon cult believes essentially in killing their enemies. I mean, these people are really, really sick and scary. And I think it's still small, but if Trump drags people along with him, and everybody I talk to seems to think that Trump is the prohibitive favorite. If he wants the nomination, he's going to get the nomination. And then if you've got, as Neil said, Joe Biden is a flawed candidate, he may be weakened by the economy, he may be weakened by immigration, he may be weakened by crime, and it may just be that people are ready for a change or ready to go back to Trump again. I wrote Trump off in 2015. I thought he was a joke. I thought it was really funny that he was running and I was kind of pleased when he started doing well in the Republican primaries because I thought, well, this is going to ensure that the Democrats are going to keep the White House. And of course, I was completely wrong about that. So I've tempered my feelings about that, tempered my optimism when things start to go wrong. I mean, you look today, Letitia James, the attorney general out in New York, and the lawsuit she filed against the Trump family. At some point in our history, that would have been a complete deal breaker for a politician to be accused of that. Mm-hmm. He and his family accused of that kind of fraud by a public official. But now it seems like people just think, oh, it's just the deep state going after their political enemies. I fully expect that not to have any particular political consequences.
Yeah, I've wondered about that.
Yeah, I think your sense of decency leads you astray, John. I mean, I really think that I'm just saying, yeah, you know, because if you look around the world, nationalism is on the rise, fanaticism is on the rise, and this plays right into it. Now, you know, I'm hoping that he's under criminal prosecution on several fronts. And Pete, and you know, and one of his acolytes dances past him. I mean, as lousy as Ted Cruz is, I don't know. I don't know if he'll have the hold. I mean, I really think that when you boil this whole, you know, I've been thinking about Trump a lot. Obviously, it's my job. He's a television star, and that's the beginning and the end for people. He gives people permission to be as lousy as they want to be and to hate the people they really want to hate and to feel like victims. And that's a powerful drug. I've written about it in terms of drug addiction. You know, you're a heroin addict, okay, and you're selling your grandmother's soul. You know, it's a bad thing, but the bottom line is you need that hit. And I really think that that's what you see with Trump, that people are just addicted and the destruction and the damage, they just don't care.
Well, I understand that there are people out there that you're describing. I'm just hoping that they aren't growing in number, and I'm expecting that there are more people that don't feel that way.
I hope you're right too, but hope, you know, and what I'm saying is, you know, we need to try to secure the election more. I mean, you see them on a local level trying to set in place a way to undermine the election system. First, they're undermining the faith in the elections, the faith in the institutions, in the FBI and the Justice Department, and, you know, and everything in the media and everything that could counter him. And, you know, so we need to try to build that faith back up, and we need to be resilient.
So now on to our first topic.
That's not our first topic. Once again, I derailed the podcast. Once again, I apologize to John.
And once again, I appreciate it. In fact, we may talk a little bit about these charges against the Trump family and business in a minute. But we'll start with something more local. It happened again. Two police officers this week stopped their unmarked car in the Pilsen neighborhood, and an unarmed young man approached their vehicle. They opened fire. 23-year-old did have a bottle of wine and a phone in one hand. He waved the other empty hand at the cops. Now both officers are charged with aggravated battery and official misconduct. Making matters worse, the report they filed of the incident does not match the video that we've been able to see. For instance, they were not fired upon first. Another individual in the incident, a juvenile, did have a gun, and the officer's attorney says that he pointed the gun at them, but that's not evident in the video. I don't know why this thing went down. The officers were on their way to a meeting. They backed up their vehicle when they went past some young men. And then as the young man in the hoodie with the wine and the phone approaches them, they open fire on him. And maybe it wasn't clear to them what he did or didn't have in his hand. But why do they lie in the reports? Because it seems like everything is captured on video. It's not that is worse, but the lie makes it so much worse.
The lie makes it much, much worse that if these guys had filed accurate police reports and been able to say that maybe in the confusion of the moment this happened, but they filed absolutely false reports. They said that they were fired on first. There's nothing that shows that. And there's no evidence. You can watch the whole surveillance video that the young man who was shot in the white hoodie did not make any aggressive motions toward the police. He didn't have anything threatening in his hand. No. Why they shot him is preposterous. And it reminds me of the whole Laquan McDonald story, which to me, the obviously the horrifying part was that they fired 16 shots into this young man walking down the street away from them. But the fact that not only did the police officers involved in Laquan McDonald lie about, directly involved, but all the police officers on the scene seemed to conspire to concoct this narrative of this extremely aggressive person who's charging at them with a knife. And it's so much is captured on video now, and the police still sort of reflexively tell the story. And then they say, well, you know, it was the fog of the moment, we forgot. But every time they tell a story like that, it seems like it's exculpatory for them, that they're the ones who are somehow victims. It's not like if the fog is in memory, they wouldn't remember it. It would sometimes go one way, sometimes go the other. It's always, oh, we were fired on. No, you weren't fired on. And if the other guy fired on them, fine, okay, then you got to fire back at him. But the kid, the young man in the white sweatshirt that we see in that video, he did not threaten them. He did not fire upon them.
Well, why do you think they fired upon him?
I don't know. I mean, it's adrenaline, a real rush of adrenaline. I don't know how do you explain something.
Guess would be that they did think they saw. I mean, he had two objects in his hand: a phone, a bottle of wine. Is one of those things a gun? He's raising his hand. I mean, we've seen that play out before. Scenarios.
He was raising his other hand.
Yeah, I know.
And if they said that, if they had even said that in the report,
sure, right.
But
right.
They didn't even say that. I mean,
right.
So how can you believe if now they tell you, oh, we thought he had a gun, we thought he was going to shoot us? Well, that's an old story we hear from police officers.
So why? I mean, before they go out every morning when they have that little meeting, like an NYPD blue or whatever, you know, where they say, okay, be careful out there. I'd say, be careful out there. And remember, everything is being videotaped. And I'm not talking just about your body cams. Every store has a camera pointed on the street. Your actions will be recorded. So tell the truth if anything goes south.
Well, the message goes against police policy, unspoken policy. Remember that report where someone did say, I might have done something? No, it never happens, because the automatic, you know, the thin blue line mentality is that they're the besieged victims. and they have to stick together and support each other in all ways at all times. And so, you know, and so it's just not truth. I don't think is on the table when it comes to these sorts of situations. I mean, look, it's inevitable. I have sympathy for the police because they're in dangerous situations and mistakes happen. Okay, but as you're saying, as Eric said, it makes it worse when you lie about it coming out of the box and then try to tap dance around what is right there in front of you. And, you know, they fall into this trap again and again. People make mistakes. I don't know why they're not allowed to make mistakes in their own minds. Okay, I thought he had a gun, but he didn't.
That perfectly makes sense to me that you have these situations. And I agree with you, Neil, that the police are – we need good police officers. I respect police officers. I think most of them do a really important job. And I hate to feel like I'm anti-cop. I'm not. I don't feel like I am anti-cop. But when you have situations like this, it not only harms them. They're going in the dock. They may spend some time in prison. I don't know. But it hurts the relationship that other police officers have with other civilians, yeah. Other citizens. I mean, this kind of thing is metastatic.
Well, also this week, a police officer was shot in a road rage incident. And
we don't know that had anything to do with her being a police officer, though. She was off duty and someone rammed her car from behind.
Yeah.
You know, we don't really know what happened there. But with the police, they have this dynamic that if you hold them to account for their actions, then they're not being supported and they can't do their jobs. And maybe it's from the years where the cops could do whatever they wanted with impunity. But we decided as a society, we didn't like that. You know, we didn't like where you could just go shoot the bad guy, lie on the report, be done with it. Because they abused that right after years and years. And now, and also because of technology, frankly, we haven't changed so much. There's just cameras everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's made us have an account. And we think about it. I mean, imagine where we'd be if there weren't all those, you know, cameras started going back to L.A. 20 years ago, 25 years ago. You know, it in a sense, it's our technology forcing us into an accountability that we don't really want or we really can't handle.
That's an interesting point. And I think that the video in this case, we haven't mentioned this, is that after that 23-year-old man was shot and was lying there, shot in the back and the leg, moaning in pain, the police officers did not approach him. Not only the two officers that were first on the scene, but then additional officers that arrived. No one got within 10 feet of that guy. A couple of other people sort of tried to render some assistance, but they shooed those people away. And not until the fire truck arrives with the EMTs does anybody even approach that man.
Well, that can be the baseline problem here, John, is that a lot of cops don't view the people they police as human beings. And so they don't have sympathy. Then they'd be dying in the street in front of them. And
I mean, it was 5 minutes before the police. I think it was about 5 minutes. I'm trying to remember the scroll of the minute bar as I was watching. It was about a 6 minute video. And I think that kid was shot in the first minute. And it's a 6 minute video. I think about 5 minutes lapsed before the EMTs finally arrived. The police walked around him.
Right. I do want to point out, though, I want to go back and want to revisit the Adam Toledo story. When the officer who shot Adam Toledo realized that the Adam Toledo had discarded his gun in the fraction of a second before the shot was fired, that officer, the other video from that scene shows that officer was really wrecked by it.
Absolutely.
He was shattered. He did not go out that day trying to kill a kid, and he was very concerned. He even they tried their best to save him, to help him. I mean, I'm not, you know, I don't want to really go way back into that story again, but not all these cops are heartless, and not all these cops when they get into situations like this are inclined to lie about it. So but it is a really difficult job, and I feel like they feel disrespected.
Yeah.
And there are constraints on them that weren't there, as Neil points out. And they're like, they can't chase. They have to sit there and watch. There's this incident recently where there are these groups of robbers and armed robbers on the northwest side, and they go through a neighborhood, and then recently the police identified the vehicle, began chasing it, and then the vehicle went on to the Kennedy to escape, and the police department had to call off the chase and say, well, we can't do a high-speed chase on the Kennedy, which is totally understandable and smart, but you can imagine the frustration that you would feel as a law enforcement officer to say, like, yeah, let him go. There are a lot of issues here.
Speaking of the frustration of the police, Superintendent David Brown is scoring the city's handling of the Mexican Independence Day weekend, this past weekend, as a win. He wants to talk about the positives, and they include very little violence in a weekend of closed streets and loud noise and disruption of life along the easternmost portion of the city, along the lake, up and down Lakeshore Drive. Not everyone feels that way, including the people who were downtown Friday night, and some took 3 hours to get from, this is an incident from one of our listeners, 3 hours to get from the Chicago Theater after a show at 10 o'clock. It took them 3 hours to get to the Kennedy to go home. That's a matter of about maybe a mile, maybe not even a mile, from the Chicago Theater to the Kennedy ramp. It took them 3 hours to get that distance because of all of the congestion, which is what David Brown said. He goes, it's very frustrating, a lot of congestion, but all things considered, it went pretty well.
I wasn't that due to more than raising the bridges and the steps trying to control the crowds downtown? I'm not so sure it was because of the celebration itself. I was wondering how much of this is cultural, but, you know, we don't just, you know, that mainstream white Chicago doesn't necessarily like people waving flags out the window and honking their horns and yelling, which is not in and of itself criminal activity. I think some of the steps the city took trying to thwart that is the reason why your listener took 3 hours to get to the Kennedy.
I'm not sure exactly what the roadblocks were that person ran into per se. Was it a bridge up they had to go around? They didn't mention that.
I had heard that the city raised the bridges again. Or something.
I know they put like snow plows on some of the exit and entrance ramps to sort of keep people from the suburbs, I guess, from coming in. But you've seen the scenes that we're talking about. If you get behind that or in the middle of that, you're screwed.
But if that was the, let's say that was the, you know, I've tried to get to work during the marathon or something. I mean, things happen where you can't get from point A to point B. And we're not sitting around going, gosh, I couldn't get to work because of the marathon. The city, the world's coming to an end. These were enthusiastic people celebrating a holiday. But again, you know, that's why you live in a city, is so that people can congregate and do stuff.
I think it's a reminder of the lawlessness, the lack of civility, the inability of Chicago to sort of control crowds, violent or celebratory or both. It's a reminder of how unable we are to manage things. I mean, it looks that way if it's only an inconvenience.
You're absolutely right. I mean, Chicago is getting a reputation as an unsafe place. And every time something happens that suggests don't come downtown, you're not safe here, it's not predictable, it feeds into that narrative and it becomes, to me, a very self-fulfilling thing.
I really have enjoyed over the years the displays of ethnic pride from Puerto Ricans and Mexicans as they drive through our neighborhoods, our streets, with their flags, honking their horns. I think it's pretty cool. I have to say that I've never been inconvenienced by it. But just that exuberance that they're exhibiting is, I think it's heartwarming. I'm not sure exactly when this became such a downtown focused thing, and I don't know how purposeful it is to try to block traffic, to try to keep people from moving, to try to impede others. It doesn't seem like you would have to do that in order to have your celebration. You could drive up and down Western Avenue, you know, Western and Halstead and circle the loop, go up and down DeSable Lakeshore Drive. That's great. That's fine. That's cool. But I'm not sure when it turned into something where we are going to not just celebrate, but we're going to obstruct.
Disrupt, yeah.
And I think that needs to be something that is discussed with members of that, leaders in that community. Like, let's figure out a way. God bless you and your pride and your exuberance and all that. But let's figure out a way to make this work with the city so that you're not. I think you are hearing. I think there's a letter, maybe it's the Sun Times, maybe the Tribune today. I can't remember where someone was basically saying, you know, this is an affront to their culture. It makes me think less of them, and that's not what these people
maybe want. This is a planning issue too. I mean, a couple weeks ago we had Bike the Drive. We closed Lakeshore Drive for a couple hours so that white suburbanites could bike up and down. Close the drive, let people drive up and down for a few hours celebrating Independence Day. I mean, you know, this to me strikes me as a solvable problem. Maybe the problem is they weren't accommodations made for this, And so they were trying to take place without any sort of planning.
Well, there is a Mexican Independence Day parade. There's a fest, isn't there? A couple weeks ago, Eric described the drifting issue, which is taking place, where intersections get closed down by young people racing their cars around in circles as a finger to the police in the city. And this felt more like that than the marathon or bike the drive. Those are licensed, organized, advertised events. Those are sanctioned.
What I'm saying is this could be sanctioned too.
What are you going to sanction, though? I mean, that we're going to give you all the streets downtown for 3 nights? Say we did that. If I'm reading what Eric was suggesting the other day, gosh, I wish he were here. It would be that if you said, let's do that, okay, you can do your drifting in the parking lot at Soldier Field, then they wouldn't go to the drifting of parking lots because that kills the fun. That's not the vibe that we're going for here.
I don't know if it is just an artifact of this celebration or if it's part of the intent. Are the people who are doing this, are they trying to obstruct people? Are they trying to be a pain in the ass, to put it bluntly? I mean, is that the goal?
Answer your question. What do you think?
And if it is, I don't know. But if it is that, then we have a problem that's very difficult to solve. But if it's just like, hey, we're out partying, celebrating, we're having a good time, we're not trying to stop anyone from getting to the Kennedy Expressway from the Loop. But that is an unfortunate part of this. But again, I want to get back to this point that if the goal is to, as you celebrate your heritage and the independence, are you trying to burnish the reputation, the image of your people, or are you trying to make people curse under their breath at you? Does seem to be what you took calls on this, John.
Yeah.
And what was the sentiment?
More like me than you guys on this. It's that sort of lawlessness. My listeners were frustrated with it. And you know, it's another reason why some people say, I'm not going to come downtown. I'm about done trying to persuade those people to come downtown. I'm like, you know, I come downtown. I work downtown. When I have free time, I entertain myself downtown. If you don't want to come downtown, I can't fix that for you anymore. So I need to stop worrying about that. But these images don't do us any good. Governor DeSantis of Florida and Governor Abbott of Texas are in a race to become not just their state's next governors, but maybe even the next president of the United States. DeSantis of Florida has flown Venezuelan migrants from Texas to Martha's Vineyard to make the point that President Biden's not doing enough to secure the borders. I think we can talk about the handling of these people without having to resolve the issue of migrants in America. That is, when you have these conversations with people, they say, well, what about this or what about that? Why aren't they doing a better job in the administration keeping 2 million migrants from coming into the United States or whatever? And I think, hey, I'm interested in that conversation, but that's actually not what I'm talking about right now. I'm talking about the handling of those human beings and the treatment that you're giving them. And I almost think that's, well, for me, a very different issue. Mayor Lori Lightfoot says that in her next budget, it will include money for migrants sent here from Texas.
It's a cruel display using actual people who've, you know, walked across a portion of South America to get here. Our country's always been a beacon for immigrants. Not to bring up the former president, but he's shown you can get a lot of mileage by being cruel to the right people, and that's what they're doing here. DeSantis was trying to show how the people on Martha's Vineyard were like hypocrites or something, and even when they came out and enforced to help those people, again, they ignored the reality of that, and they focused on the fact they didn't settle them there in Martha's Vineyard, but took them to nearby Boston to help get them on their way to where they actually wanted to go. And so, you know, if we see more of this, and we probably will, it's a shocking use of families, of mothers and fathers and children, and abusing them for political purposes, which sadly will probably do very well for Abbott and for DeSantis.
Yeah, I feel like it's fair enough to distribute the problem of all of people coming into the country seeking asylum seekers and needing a place for them to stay while their cases are being adjudicated, to distribute that issue, that burden around the country. I think that's fair. The way they're doing it, of course, is just like a stunt. And
yeah, there's no pre-planning. They didn't say, hey, Illinois, hey, California, hey, you know, Massachusetts, we want to start sending you immigrants. Let's put our heads together. That's a very, right. That's a sensible, a defendable approach. But that, as you said, is not what they were doing.
Yeah, and if they had done that, I would say, well, that's fair enough. That there's no reason why the southern border states have to absorb all the difficulties and the burdens of accommodating and housing and feeding these people who are, as Neil points out, these are human beings in many cases fleeing very difficult circumstances. They're coming here to a land of opportunity that they hope will help their families have a better life, and it is the kind of beacon that the United States has been for centuries. And I don't see why we should necessarily turn our backs on them because they are brown skinned, if that's what the issue is here. But
well, should we turn our backs on them because they're here illegally?
Well, no, the people who they're flying around, I believe, are people who are asylum.
Venezuelans who are seeking asylum. I know that, but that's the narrative. I mean, I'll play the devil's advocate for you here. Then don't show up. If you don't like the fact that we put you on, as one of my listeners said to me, an air-conditioned airplane and flew you to Massachusetts, then don't show up.
I'm sorry, John. That's nonsense. So you might as well cut off their pinkies then. That'll keep people from coming in. I mean, you can't say we're going to treat people inhumanely so that people don't come.
Where's the inhumane treatment?
The inhumane treatment is taking somebody, is lying to them, and sending them, forget the air conditioning on the airplane. If you show up in a certain place and I say, okay, here, you know, you go to this place and you're going to get these services, it was deceptive. And again, United States needs immigrants. We always have. They benefit the country. They become better Americans than the Americans already here. And to do this demonizes them. Shave their head and ride them out of town on a rail. I mean, all sorts. Once we get in the habit, once we normalize the idea that when people come to this country, we're going to ridicule them, we're going to make them into objects of scorn and difficulty.
Yeah.
I think it's terribly un-American and shameful.
That said, but there is a problem at the border right now, that the number of people coming across is more than we know how to handle, more than we're handling effectively. And the Biden administration has not been particularly good about addressing all those problems, the situations that arise because of that. And this is an extremely knotty problem. And it's one that has bedeviled presidents going, way back. The Republican George W. Bush tried to do some immigration reform and didn't get it done. And of course, every president since then has had his version of trying to figure out the problem. But it's not an easy problem to solve.
You could focus the conversation on the federal failure if states started to coordinate amongst themselves. Hey, can you take 10,000 immigrants, Illinois, you've been touting the fact that you're a sanctuary state, and Massachusetts, California, New York, et cetera, and then they could move them, and that would have got press, and it would have, I think, illustrated the problem, but it would not have been such a flashpoint as dropping them at the vice president's home or dropping them on Martha's Vineyard and then getting laughs from people in Florida. But that's why I said in my introduction to this, we're not talking about that right now. I'm talking about the inhumane treatment of these people, because that's what pulls my heartstrings, and that's what you did.
We have a country that's economically successful, more or less, that's a beacon to the world, more or less, that people come to, more or less. And I don't understand why, as a country, we can't set up a system that says, okay, well, actually, we have one. It's just it's overwhelmed. It hasn't. It's underfunded, and it's criminalized. Where we need to work up a place that when people show up here, we know what to do with them, and put them on a route to citizenship, or allow them to work here temporarily, or whatever. Obviously, we're screaming for employees at all levels. And we need people to come in, and people are coming in, and we should have a coherent, human, rational, transparent system where they can come to this country and do well.
Well, do you think that this will backfire on DeSantis or Abbott a little bit? Remember the beginning of our conversation where I said reasonable people, even reasonable Republicans, will see through this. It's transparent.
I think that their base loves this. I think that they're setting themselves up for the sort of success that Donald Trump had. And, all the optimists in my family are back in Poland in a pit. And so I think that this is, they know exactly what they're doing and it's going to work.
I agree with Neil. I think this is playing to the base. I think that DeSantis is involved in a reelection campaign right now. He's running against Charlie Crist down in Florida. And I believe the polls are showing him winning that race. Abbott is running against Beto O'Rourke. I haven't seen the latest polling on that, but if anything, this will probably strengthen Abbott's hand in that election. Again, we're going to learn a lot in November as to where the American public is. You see polls taken, opinion polls about various issues, about abortion, about immigration, about crime, about inflation. And it's all about the priorities that these candidates have, the priorities that voters have, because there is no candidate out there. The candidates don't necessarily have answers, but they have reactions to these topics. So you have someone who's like, well, I'm frustrated by the way things are going now, so I'm just going to vote for somebody who is ringing my chimes in a certain way. So we'll see what is ringing the chimes of the voters.
Illinois' two Mega Millions winners, currently anonymous, each get $390 million. How about that? They have a moral obligation, I said on the radio today, to give most of that away. The winning ticket was bought on Toohey Avenue in Des Plaines. And that hot take of mine, which I ran it up the flagpole, was quite successful in pissing off most of my listeners. But I see that much money as a great opportunity for something, for good. Left in the bank or spent on a yacht, I see as lost opportunity. This is how my sanctimony goes, that you didn't earn. You don't even deserve the opportunity. It just fell in your lap. It's as if you were walking down the street and you saw a couple $5 bills, and most of us would tip a waitress or give it to a homeless person or share it with the person next to us or something like that. I said, if you're walking down the street and you see $390 million and you pick it up, Ed, don't you think you should give a lot of that away because you didn't earn it? That's not even your money. I said,
I have to compliment you, John, because in all the years I've been thinking about the lottery and writing about the lottery, I've never heard that idea floated before. And I'm not being sarcastic. I'm being honest. It's actually a new thought.
It's opportunity cost almost lost when you just hoard it. I said, you're a hoarder now. I may talk myself out of your good graces here, but I was very frustrated by the fact that that money, maybe it will be put to some anonymous good, but then I want to know about that, because otherwise I feel like, wow, what a waste of $1 billion right here in River City.
Given how many people wreck their lives and blow their fortunes and become very unhappy, I mean, it's not a majority. Most people manage to deal with the money. But I do think your suggestion is to have a program of philanthropy is a good one, if only to ensure your own happiness, that when you've blown through the $390 million, if you have got that hospital you endowed down in Haiti or whatever. I think I would almost expand your thought and think that everybody, no matter what we have, should give more to other people, and that if we can't do it for their benefit, we should do it for ours. There's a wonderful study in Illinois about people who win the lottery and people who are become quadriplegics or paraplegics in car accidents. And what it found is that in both conditions, you tend to revert back to the happiness you had before. So it doesn't affect you all that much. And that makes sense to me. Is as much as you think this is life-changing, you're still the person you were the day before you won it. And the sad answer to your question is probably few people probably play the lottery thinking that they're going to start a school somewhere. But I like your suggestion, if only to expand the minds of everybody else.
Well, you sure didn't call my show today.
it also makes me think of the enormous salaries that we pay to athletes, and wondering, we seem to don't blink at the in these $100 million contracts, and we don't make that kind of demand of the athletes. And at some point, how much money can you really spend? You can provide for your own future, and you can provide for the future of your children, your grandchildren, and create endowments. But you've still got, these people have $390 million each. I would guess that $10 or $20 million could salt away a family's good fortune for several generations.
Oh, yeah.
So why not, as Neil says, why not say, okay, what am I going to do with that money? I have the same question again about people, these ultra wealthy people who make staggering amounts of money. Athletes come right to mind. Is think of all the people who don't even have a place to sleep at night. Think of the people who don't have good schools. Think of the people who are going medically bankrupt. Think of all the people who could really use a hand up, who deserve a hand up. And here you are, as you said, John, hoarding the money. For what purpose? I don't even understand what you would want with that money.
Well, I will be rich at the end of this, fantasy of mine, but I'm going to keep $5 million. Like $5 million gets me where everything I need to be. But then I thought, but I want my sons and daughter-in-law to have $5 million, and I want my granddaughter to have $5 million. So I'll go back to a couple generations and I'll endow us all. I could do that for $5, $10, $50. I could do that for $20 million. I would still have $370 million to help Corey Brooks put a community center in Englewood. You know, I mean, it would just think it, you're right, Neil. I would be happier giving it away.
I'm sorry if I keep expanding on your notion, but I think that if in general, you know, we could encourage people to consider that they are part of a community. You know, those police officers in the car might not have shot that young man. Exuberant Mexicans might not have blocked traffic the way they did. I mean, I think in general, our communal ties are very, very frayed. And we see where that leads us and we see where that's going. So, I was sincere when I said I had never heard it suggested, what are you going to do charity-wise with your money? But even just to ask that question to winners, I think it's an important use of your megaphone, not to get all serious on you.
Well, and also, as you alluded to, Neil, those of us around the virtual table here, we are winners in life's lottery in many ways. And some of that obligation is incumbent on us as well.
You're sitting there scrubbing your pits in this money shower, spread it around. And I think that's an important message that everybody should be reminded of every day.
One of my listeners also suggested that the generosity I'm asking for is, in fact, paid via the taxes that you pay on that. Remember, it was over $1 billion, and now you just have to settle with a few hundred million dollars. So the obligation to community is satisfied by the fact that you paid state and federal taxes on that.
Nah. The lottery is one big tax. Okay, it's funny. People hate taxes, and what are taxes? You give the money, and the government takes it, and they distribute it. So what's a lottery? You give all this money, and the government takes a share, and then they hand it to some jamoke, and he distributes it. So in a sense, we should pay taxes much more happily than we play the lottery. But because of that selfish, and you know, I use Fran Lebowitz's line that the odds of winning the lottery are the same whether you play it or not. Okay, so what people are really paying for is they're paying, and this is why I think what you said is so important. They're paying for this fantasy of what kind of car they're going to have, what kind of fishing boat, what kind of everything. And if you could include in that fantasy, what kind of good am I going to do for people? I think that would be a huge accomplishment.
God forbid I win $100 million now and I don't do what I just said everybody else should do. I just wanted to mention... So this has just moved this afternoon. I mean, it was during my show today, late this morning, that the New York Attorney General, Letitia James, and Eric and Neil, we referred to this earlier in this podcast today, but Letitia James is suing Trump and the Trump Business Organization, seeking $250 million in relief. Just a couple of lines here from CBSNews.com. Her office has announced that and that there shall be an end to operations in the state. Here's the paragraph. James' office is asking a judge to revoke the Trump Organization's business certificate, effectively barring it from doing business in New York. Her office is also seeking to permanently bar Trump and his children named in the suit from serving as officer or director of any business entity in New York, including their family's business. It is also requesting a 5-year ban on Trump and company from acquiring real estate in New York or applying for loans from any New York-based company. Trump's attorney said that this suit is focused neither on facts nor the law, but they say there are 200 instances where the Trump Organization falsely valued their assets, sometimes actually misrepresenting square footage, and at other times just the values of apartments that nobody ever gets in New York. So there that is. And Eric, this goes back to the point earlier. You wonder if any of these things will ever stick, or will there ever be any consequences for these? They're always able to dodge or defer, and you wonder if this is ever going to come home to roost.
And of course, personally, but also politically, does this matter to his supporters, people who will come out and vote for him or donate money to him? Do they feel like this is just another example of the deep state going after its political enemy here, which is, of course, exactly how it's going to be framed on Fox News and how Trump himself is going to frame
it. Sure, but do you think this one is any different than all of those other things, criminal and civil?
I always like to think so. I'm always optimistic that this time they're going to get him, but I'm not optimistic. I have to say that it seems like he's always manages to slip the net, and he may do it again.
It's worse than that, Eric, because he's been had settlements paid off, tens of millions of dollars in fraud cases and things. So he's been hooked in the past. He doesn't always slip away, but his proven in a court of law instances of his fraudulent behavior. It doesn't affect him politically. He was a proven fraud on day one when he went down that elevator in Trump Tower, June 16th, 2015. And, until he's in a cell, and even then, Eugene Debs ran for president from prison. So I'm not optimistic that any of this is going to stick.
He called it a witch hunt and a political crusade. It does seem it's so damning in what Letitia James is saying that one wonders if this is a little bit of piling on. Are the damages that she's seeking, or the penalties that she's seeking, do those seem to be politically motivated?
When did enforcing the law be piling on? I mean, I would assume that, this seems draconian, but from every understanding I hear of the Trump Organization as an enterprise that doesn't pay its bills, that acts in a completely oily, if not fraudulent way. None of this is surprising to me. This is Napoleon Escapes from Elba stuff. This is the oldest story in the world replaying itself yet again.
The lawsuit, and just back to this article from CBSNews.com, the lawsuit comes as Trump and company face more mounting legal peril. The Trump Organization is being prosecuted in a criminal trial October 24th in Manhattan, where it will fight charges of fraud and tax evasion. The company has entered a not guilty plea in that case. Trump is at the center of at least two federal investigations, the January 6th attack on the Capitol and the Mar-a-Lago thing. And then you've got the grand jury in Fulton County, Georgia, which is investigating his conduct there on the election that he lost in 2020. So you've got I don't know how the man sleeps. I worry about a parking ticket. Imagine five investigations, criminal and civil, into you.
It's very interesting that he doesn't seem to be able to attract any high power legal talent anymore, because he has this reputation of not paying his bills. So the lawyers he has arguing for him at the in front of the special master the other day seem to be very amateurish, which is amusing.
John, I want to answer your question. He's able to sleep because he's a sociopath without a conscience. I really do think it's a problem. A lot of us, we who have who worry over a parking ticket, is we can't, we just assume that at some point, it's going to be the end of Mr. Smith goes to Washington, and he's going to the weight of his sins is never going to happen. And I think we have to understand that, or we're going to get beat again.
Put it this way. Of the five things that I just referenced, which do you think will bring the fullest freight of justice to Trump, his children, or his organization? Which has the best chance of actually being successful?
Well, the current one today, reducing his ability to defraud people in New York State, I think would be a huge success. But he can shift to Florida. He can shift to other places. I really think that he needs more of a reckoning for January 6th for his role in fomenting that riot.
Which do you think is the most likely is my question. Which of these cases?
I will say I think that the documents matter. The confidential
Mar-a-Lago stuff, yeah.
The Mar-a-Lago stuff. I think that's the one where his exposure is really vast. And the excuses that they've offered up so far have been pathetic and unpersuasive. And I think that if Merrick Garland has the stones to go and pursue that, that it's going to be very difficult for him to wriggle out of that one. He seems to wriggle out of a lot.
Well, the volume of stuff they've got to look at there. I divided the number of days by the number of documents. It's 157 documents a day between now and the end of November. And that's if they started today, but they don't even have them yet. So I'm wondering now, how does this 78-year-old, granted with a staff, get through 150-plus documents a day? If they only had 10 pages in a document, they have to resolve 1,500 pages a day for 2.5 months.
Here it helps to have two sons who are lawyers. Ripping through documents in that fashion is sort of what they do.
Really?
And they can go through an enormous, I mean, some cases have millions of documents, and they seem to be able to get through them in a timely fashion. What I'm encouraged by is this special master seems to not be taking any BS from Trump, and he seems to be calling on the carpet. You know, and the more we have of that, the more we have of decent patriotic Americans holding the laws of the country as applicable even to him, I think the better off we'll be.
So all the time I have today, fellas. Anything else that we want to kick around?
Happy autumn.
By the way, last week I think we ended on something about the Chicago Bears and the optimism that fans should or should not have after this past weekend's game. The team is still 1-1. I mentioned that the over-under for the season, according to most of the books in Vegas, was 5.5 games out of 17 played. I don't know if they could have won that game against Green Bay, but they were that close to making it interesting, which is different than winning. Everybody has been railing all week about how we blew that game, and I must be the only person with slightly rose-colored glasses. I'm like, eh. If you told me at the beginning of the season we'd be 1-1 after playing San Francisco and Green Bay, and we're mad that we aren't 2-0, I'd say that was a pretty good start.
John, they looked so bad.
Did they really? So did the Bears look that bad? They had one really bad quarter, and then they had three quarters where half of the game they were winning.
You just never after Green Bay poured it on, there just seemed to be no oomph in that team at all. And yeah, if they had given Justin Fields that touchdown toward the end of the game, maybe you could say that it would have been a more interesting game. But Justin Fields, he threw 11 passes.
Yeah, he was asked Montgomery to throw 11 passes.
Montgomery looked great running the ball. They were putting the ball through the line for a while, but then Green Bay seemed to kind of get the measure of them on that, and they just never were able to stop Green Bay either through the air or on the ground. I think 5.5 wins looks optimistic at this point, but we'll see.
Well, in true Bears fashion, if everybody has one heart-wrenching play or call on the goal line, on the 8-inch line, you just hike it to the quarterback and say, okay, see what you can get done there in the shotgun formation.
The shotgun formation, John, no. What's a big mistake?
Neil, thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you. A pleasure. Anytime, John. Good seeing you again, Eric.
Yeah, good seeing you. I'll see you soon, Neil.
And Eric Zorn. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another pod on you next week.
All right, that was fun, Neil. Thanks. That was really,
really good great. Time, guys.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.